Hey, this is Billy West, and I'm a lot of voices on Futurama, and you're listening to Spoiler Country. That couldn't be right. Why would anybody in their right mind name a podcast Spoiler Country? Well, I'll tell you why. Because all the other names were taken. Oh, I love that fry.
Hey, people of Earth, it's time to enter the Spoilerverse via our secret portal at the exclusive Arctic Club in beautiful downtown Seattle with our hosts, John and Kenrick and Jeff. Welcome to Spoiler Country.
Hey, if you're listening to our show for the first time and you're on one of the social medias that we're on, like Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, any of those kinds of things, you should always check us out on Spoilerverse.com. But if you want to keep up with our latest episodes, you should bring out your smartphone, get into your favorite podcatcher, find Spoiler Country, and hit subscribe. Then you'll get all our new stuff.
And if you want to reach out to us, you can do that in two ways. You can call us, leave us a voicemail at 707-656-2080. Again, 707-656-2080. Or you can shoot us an email at spoilercountry@gmail.com. All right, guys, welcome back to Spoiler Country. I am Johnny Horsley. I'm joined once again by the amazing Robert Slavinsky. Well, maybe not the amazing, but the Robert Slavinsky of the world, the only one that I know, the Slavinskys.
Ouch.
I am nothing, but I am honest, okay? But he's a host of Bridging Geekdoms. He is the host of Shooting the Sith. He is a big contributor to the Spoilerverse website, and he's joining me today to do his intro-outro for the amazing Billy West.
What's going on, everybody? I am looking forward to this episode. Billy West is one of those he's such a well-known and well-established voice actor. Mm-hmm. People probably know him best from Futurama, but there are a plethora of other things that he has been part of over the last 20, 30 years.
Ralph Roach and Joe's Apartment, Colin and Osmosis Jones. I mean, these are memorable characters here. You know, Sumo Singer and Rugrats in Paris. I mean, various voices in Jimmy Neutron Boy Genius. Come on.
But you know, a little known fact, which we kind of just found out myself. Well, I found out myself. He was Bugs Bunny and Elmer Fudd in Space Jam. Like, come on.
That's amazing. I hope they use him for Space Jam too, right? If they ever actually make that movie, they use him as well. I thought it was
already shot, wasn't it?
Whatever. I don't know. I keep hearing background. I try my best, even though you run Rumorverse on the website, I try my best not to get into rumors and stuff so I can just be surprised. So
I gotcha. Yeah, makes sense.
But anyways, let's just go ahead and stop wasting time here and get right into it.
Hello, listeners of Spoiler Country. Today on the show, we have a very special guest, Mr. Billy West. How are you doing, Mr. West?
I'm okay. What about you? I'm laying low and playing by the rules.
I'm doing okay. I'm getting a little tired of COVID right now, but I guess that's life.
I know. It seems like it's been a year of sitting inside the house.
It doesn't have a certain, like, unending feel to it. Like, I can't remember the world prior to COVID, and I'm really looking forward to getting past this one.
Well, hopefully it won't be much longer, but I think there's some variables that nobody can control, and that's why the disease continues.
I do agree. I will say, like, walking around the grocery stores and people not wearing their masks is not helping things.
No, it's not. But what are you going to do? It's like, I never dreamt that when I was a kid, that would have been a horrible nightmare to, like, wake up in a world where there were people that were ready to kill you over a piece of cookie or a mask, or, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or toilet, or what do you call it? Paper towel roll.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely changes kind of how you see your society that you live in. I would have always, if you had asked me maybe 10 years ago, in case of a pandemic or any major issue, do you think people would do the small things necessary to keep others safe? My answer would be, well, that's duh. You know, obviously we would do that. And now going through this, I think to myself, apparently not.
Well, everybody used to be on the same page years ago. You know what I mean? There wasn't, like, 200 agendas, 200 different ways of life that have nothing to do with anybody else's life. So it's all over the place. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I totally do agree. And I do hope that over the next few months, we can get back on track and try to figure out what derailed us to begin with. A lot of us would have our own opinions on that. And figure out and get back to the point where we are all facing the same direction again.
Yeah, it would be wonderful.
That we all then have to wake up from our wonderful dream. So, well, one thing I found kind of interesting when I was doing some research about you, and I hope you don't mind us discussing it.
No.
But when I'm not doing my podcast, or the podcast that I'm a part of, not mine, I'm a teacher, a high school teacher at a superior school. And a lot of my students have issues such as ADHD and autism, which I read that you something that you dealt with growing up as well.
Yes.
And I thought that was I thought it would be something very interesting to hear your thoughts on, because once again, my students deal with the same issues.
Let's see. There's no way to know when you actually have autism of some degree and ADHD to varying degrees. You have no idea that you might be a step towards a change in evolution. You know, that people that have these things, it's like a foreshadowing of the future, that the gifts that people will be able to develop. You know, all the artistic people that I've ever dealt with have tremendous gifts locked up inside. And there's something about the condition they have that allows them to access these locked storage rooms that are locked to regular people. We don't have the keys to them, but there are storehouses of gifts and amazing talents and things like that, that they have access to. And, you know, they're really trying to figure it out, trying to make a study of it. ADHD, I think, is also one of those genetic disorders where you have imbalanced chemistry. You know, I went through it, and it's like makes life hellish for you. But if you're going to look in terms of winning and losing, I mean, I gained an awful lot of gifts. I mean, I was given all these abilities and stuff that's not normal. I always thought that talent was a form of mental illness. And because it's aberrant to the human condition, you know what I mean?
Mm.
And so, you know, I think those kind of things are good things that happen. And more people might become more sensitive and more artistic over time.
For those people who don't have to deal with things such as autism, mm-hmm. How would you try to describe the experience to them? Or is that possible?
It's impossible because I'm used to having to process everything upside down backwards. Ever since I was a kid, that's how I process everything. Upside down backwards, but I would find a way to do what the target was, like tying my shoes. I could not tie them, but I made up my own version of them and they worked just fine. It's strange, but you know, I mean, I couldn't see it for what it was. I couldn't see when someone was showing me, no, this goes here and this goes there. Impossible for me to read.
Hmm.
And so afterwards, I would, you know, sort of deconstruct the situation and put it together my own way. Same thing with a necktie. Couldn't tie a necktie. No, stupid. It goes like this. All you got to do is put it under here and pull it over here, you know, and it was like a foreign language to me. But processing everything upside down backwards, I figured out a way to tie a tie that looked halfway normal.
What is the key to working with or help instructing those who do deal with autism, like I said, as someone who's a teacher working with those students?
You have to try to mimic the language that seems to be coming from them. And then they will open up more to you and you'll be able to slowly figure out what it is that they mean when they talk about something or you know, what makes them laugh, what makes them sad. It's like a whole other set of circumstances. And you got to try to identify with it. No one had any tolerance for kids like that when I was growing up, especially my dad. I mean, God, you know, it was just, what's wrong with you? What's wrong with you? And I, you know, I'd get hit a lot, smacked over the head for this, that, and the other thing. And being able to survive that, I don't know. I don't know what to make of it, except that I was given something that saved my ass in life. Because I couldn't understand anything in school. I couldn't understand math. I hated school. I was counting the days, like, on a piece of paper or a calendar, what year I would be able to leave that hell. You know, and I didn't care if I knew anything or not. It was just, I couldn't learn anything, period. End of sentence, no matter what anybody tried to do to teach me. And, you know, and I wound up in a future where, thank God I do what I do. It has nothing to do with anything that I ever learned in school. Nothing. You know, it's like I can work. I can work, like, you know, abundantly because of the nature of the job I do. You know, you have setups at home now and everything. You don't have to travel. You don't have to go to a studio. It's a far cry from, you know, what I did my whole life with this. But I mean, nothing in school could make me ready for the year 2020. Nothing. None of it. Yeah. They teach people math and I couldn't understand math. And then, wow, I wake up in a future where there's this genius device. Well, why would anybody need to learn math for anything? Your answer's right there in the palm of your hand.
Right.
I did have a love of language though. And I liked plays. I liked reading stuff that I could understand, but it would have to do with art. It would have to be about something that was interesting to me for me, my brain to process it.
I do think there's a lot of students and probably a lot of parents who find autism to be a sentence of failure for their life. They don't understand what they can accomplish. To those types of individuals who do feel that or feel defeated by the difficulties that they have, what would you say is the key to your success?
Well, I had at least one nurturing parent, my mom, who tried to understand where I was going, you know, what I was thinking, what I was doing, and how I went about it. At least she kept an eye on things, and she was always helpful to me. You know, I mean, because I can just imagine a kid, what their parents feel like when a little kid comes to them one day and says, Mom, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? There's no easy answers there. You know, normally they would just say, oh, there's nothing wrong with you. You know, it's going to work itself out. And it did it. I didn't, you know, because I came up in a turbulent house. My dad was hyper violent and a drunk and a crazy and a mental case. And, you know, I mean, I had to cut through scar tissue for years to even approach being normal. You know, it was just bad luck. But the thing is look at the gift somehow in there that was enclosed in that miserable package. You know, and I found it. I found it because that's all I could do. You know, when I was a little kid running around rocket ships and, you know, screaming soldiers and, you know, noises and voices and singing, everything, you know, would just pour out of me.
I do definitely believe that definitely frustration or aggravation with someone who is dealing with the difficulty is definitely not going to make the situation ever better. It just seems to make things always that much worse and long lasting, is my thoughts.
Well, it's, I don't know. It's like, you know, teenagers are always like, you know, they get to a point and they're just fed up and they don't want to be told anything and they don't want to, and then they even resent someone trying to understand them. You know, it's like, you know, I can't stand to be misunderstood. I can't, you know, it's one of those things. And I think it's prevalent in a few things like hyper attention deficit disorder.
Is there a way to be, if a teenager is feeling like that, as you said, because I hadn't really thought of the idea of why, you know, of being angry at being misunderstood. What should you just keep trying as an adult or a teacher, or do you want to give them space when they're like that?
I wish I knew, but I try to think of it in terms of evolution, that this might be the next step, the complicated, painful step in our evolution changing once again, as it always has and always will.
Has it been, and you said it, you know, the fact that you do what you do as a voice actor.
Yes.
And also prior you did some radio stuff we'll discuss in a minute. That has been a definite benefit for you in dealing with some of the issues that you have. How has it been a complication for you?
In what regard? I'm sorry.
To get an idea, my guess is, I have not ever been a celebrity, obviously, is that it's a very socially, you know, a necessary type job that you do have to constantly be interacting, constantly being approached. Having them is usually seen as a relatively antisocial, but it makes interaction difficult.
Well, it's something that always kept me alive was I was always trying to entertain others or make other people laugh. I used to think that's the reason I existed. You know, people would be angry and fighting, and then I would just show up and do something stupid. And, you know, and they would go, What was that? You know, and I stayed with that. That's how I thought in my own little way that I could bring people together. But I think ultimately, you know, the most noble thing you can do is be like somebody who saves other people's lives, or a doctor or someone like that, first responders. But I think the second most noble thing is being able to make people laugh. I think it's very noble that someone can do that.
And I mean, without getting too any cliche on that, the idea is, I think being able to make someone laugh, entertain them, can also be the thing that kind of saves them a little bit too, because I think people need that. I mean, especially when, like I said, in time of COVID and people are locked down, mm-hmm. So something about just some entertaining and giving them something to laugh about and be happy is one of the most important things you can do for someone in many instances.
It's a complicated thing. I know that there are so many things, you know, of esoteric value and interest, but kept my life happy, you know, when I needed to surround myself with something that was happy, you know, whether it was performers that I idolized or, you know, just watch them work, look at their works, listen to them, you know, inspiration and passion. That was always there. I always had those two things.
Now, in your early career, you spent performing comedic routines on a radio station in Boston. Mm-hmm. Was that a normal evolution from trying to make people laugh to moving into your stand-up routine?
Yes, stand-up. I didn't do well because if I prepared material, it wasn't pure and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't from the heart, and people couldn't relate to it because it was written and it was overprepared. And, you know, I was better off just being spontaneous and just let whatever happened happen. But you're risking your life from room to room with that. You can, you know, you can either soar like an eagle one night and then go to hell on a twisted metal fireball. So that's, I didn't want to live like that. So luckily I got into radio and it was the perfect match for me because that's where I was most needed as a sonic entity.
So how did you go from radio then to doing voice over performances?
Well, they went hand in hand because I used to create characters for these morning shows that I worked on in Boston. And I moved to New York and I worked with Howard Stern for a few years. And I was doing voices for his show and everything. But in the meantime, I had been auditioning for commercial voiceovers and animation. And I started to make some headway. People were beginning to take a good look and go, let's get him back here. I want to see what else he can do, that kind of stuff.
Now, later in your voice work, you ended up doing some voices that were previously done by the most famous voiceover performer of all time, Mel Blanc.
Yes.
Is there a special kind of pressure in attempting to do voice work for such legendary characters?
Well, yeah, it was frightening. It was absolutely, you know, frightening to try and approximate what Mel Blanc did. I could do the voice. I knew what he did, so I could do things that people expected because that's what they were, you know, the character had outlined specified for audiences. You knew who you were dealing with immediately, but I had to like listen on a different level, and you know, you had to be fine tuned. And I was just like, you know, and then you got to please everybody. It's like some people like the Bugs Bunny from the 40s, some like the one from the 80s. So you had to like try to go with it instinctively, like what beats from what eras. And yeah, it was really tough. Really tough. But I was honored to do it. I'm glad that they, you know, trusted me to interpret the character. And that's how I feel about all the characters. But I do prefer to create them out of the blue.
When you're doing a famous character like Bugs Bunny and Elmer Fudd, are you able to try to make it your, or were you encouraged to try to make your version of it? Or was there really is that pressure to go, you need to do Bugs Bunny from this era or that era? Or could you be, let's hear Billy West's version of Bugs Bunny?
Well, I always tried to put in something of my own, but it had to be a very slight contribution because that wasn't the assignment. The assignment was to approximate Mel Blanc as faithfully as possible. You know, so I mean, that's how I did it. And there are other artists that do Bugs Bunny and have for the movies and, you know, commercials and stuff. And we all, I don't know, it seemed like we all had our 1-2 punch, even though we were mimicking a character. But the reason they varied just slightly stylistically is because of who it was coming from. You know, little subtle differences.
Because you have done voice work for so many famous characters now, many of the characters we'll go into later in the interview, do you ever stop and wonder how you will feel later on when a different voice actor does some of the characters that you previously performed? And how do you think you'll feel about that?
Let's see. I guess I'd be honored, you know? I mean, if I wasn't able to do it or they just, you know, I'd probably be angry if they didn't call me. But I mean, that's how I started. You know, there were people that were just not able to do certain things and not able to, you know, so they would recast stuff. And I came in on that kind of level, you know, replacing original people. I think mostly it was because they had either passed away or they just refused to do it. But there are people that were just too old to do it or infirmed, you know, and it's like time goes on. It's like, you know, I'll be reckoning with that kind of stuff. I don't know when, but I don't know. There's people that are doing gigs that I've done and I give them my blessing. I wish them nothing but the best.
Had Mel Blanc had already passed, right? Prior to you performing Bugs Bunny and Elmer Fudd, correct?
Yes.
So, I mean, once again, he was definitely a great legend. But like I said, though, you yourself have started, or not started, but I mean, you have accomplished quite the legendary career on your own as a voice performer.
Which I'm glad for.
Yeah, and I don't know if you remember the character or not, but you actually performed the voice for one of my favorite cartoons of all time growing up, Project Geeker. I don't know if you remember the show or not, but to me, it was a huge deal.
I do remember it, and I remember I worked with Charlie Adler, and I worked with Big Brad Garrett.
Yep.
You know, and Jimmy Cummings.
Yep.
They were legends. All those guys. I was brand new. I mean, I had just set foot in town. And I was starting to get gigs, and I'm sitting next to these heavyweights, and I couldn't believe, you know, and I was learning. I was listening and learning, and I thought it was a pretty clever show.
What kind of advice did Brad Garrett and Jim Cummings and Charlie Adler give you about voice performing when you started the show?
I don't think I was ever soliciting for advice. You know, I mean, I was pretty cocky, you know, but Brad Garrett, you know, I'd do a bunch of stuff and he would look at me and he would just say, "Where does it come from, Billy? Where does it come from?" You know, I mean, it was like, I was the Billy verse, I guess, you know?
Yeah. I think one of the coolest things about the show, and the one reason it worked, once again, is your performance of Geeker himself. I mean, if Geeker does not work as a character or the voice doesn't work for him, the show definitely falls apart.
Right.
And a fabulous job at developing this very kind of weird, I almost use the word when I thought about his voice, like it's almost like a radical way he goes up and down in tenure, pitch, yes. I mean, of his voice. Yeah. How did you arrive at that performance?
I was willing to try anything. I never wanted to be cliche. You know, I had to always find something that would make that character bigger than the two dimensions that it occupied. Giving it a third dimension is by giving it, you know, maybe picking up on a flaw and exaggerating it. Or, you know, I was always making off-the-nose choices. My acting choices were weird, too. But I didn't want to be like anyone else, really, once I got to that point.
How was, when you got the role to begin with, how was it described to you, the character of Giger?
That he was almost like robotic, and that he contained, you know, zillions of bits of information, and he could access it or run it through his mind, but he would also, you know, audio-wise, spell out the equations, and he would sing them, or he would, you know, there were all these different possibilities for a way to perform them.
Giger definitely seemed almost like a super intelligent, almost child. You know what I'm saying? He did seem also, he's very innocent in some ways, it felt like.
Yeah, he was. I don't know. I as I got older, I was still able to do these like adolescent type voices and little kids and, you know, just lucky.
Well, like I said, it was a show that I thought was just incredible, and I think you did a wonderful job on it. Unfortunately, you're welcome. Project Giger unfortunately ran 13 episodes.
Right.
It felt it's like one of those shows, sort of like later on with sci-fi, like a show like Firefly, a show that was ended so prematurely before it even hit its full potential. And I was wondering how you felt about it.
Well, there was a guy in charge of animation, a great artist, and his name is Audu Payden. And he did the artworks. He also did the artwork for stuff like Men in Black and Ghostbusters, you know, the Ghostbusters cartoons that were later yeah. on, you know, and he was just a driving force. He was like, he was not to be ignored. He had a style that was very unique and, you know, it worked like a charm every time. And sometimes you have teams of people like that, and that's what makes something get attention. But you know, who knows why networks or executives make the decisions they make. There's no rhyme or reason, so.
Well, I mean, I know at that time period, I guess CBS had shut down this entire animated schedule.
Yep.
Unfortunately, so it feels like one of those times where it's sort of like a lot of great short-lived shows that the timing just, I guess, was off.
Yeah. Isn't it funny how, you know, they can't make television. So what do they do? They fill it all in with animation.
But
you know, who would have ever predicted that showbiz would collapse, basically? No movie theaters to show any stuff in. And, you know, who would have ever guessed or imagined that? But animation survived.
Well, I mean, once again, I guess being the situation that we're in, I guess as a voice actor, can you do the performance from home, or do you still need to enter the studio?
No, we were forced to stay in the house and, you know, put together with spit and glue some kind of recording rig that was, you know, suitable for the standards of broadcast television.
It is amazing, and I guess it almost coincides with the, oddly enough, it just coincides with the emergence of streaming as being a major force in entertainment. And right after that started getting its push, you do have COVID. It does seem to have given it almost the theater experience the final kick on
right.
some level.
You know, it's like people want control over stuff, and that's the one thing they ever had. I never had control over anything I watched except for my own personal pick at what show that I was going to watch. But you were relegated to watch it at a certain time. And there was like a helplessness about what you wanted to fill your head with. You know, I mean, I didn't like Westerns. I liked detective shows. I liked, oh, I don't know, just silly situation comedies, you know, because that was like, they were, situation comedies had run out of ideas, you know, like in the late 60s. they had just run out of ideas. They were working recycled scripts and just renaming and changing the characters and stuff. But then, little did you imagine that before television was going to become a wasteland, all the greatest shows that were ever made started popping up on cable. You know, television made this huge, you know, resurgence because they decided, look, you know, we've tried everything else. Why don't we do good stuff? Why don't we do really good stuff? And that's how I remember it. You know, like, what was that? Walking or Being Bad? What was the show?
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing too, though, is, well, obviously there was less options back in the day going through channels. I do think that offered a common experience that we lack now. I mean, the odds of bumping into people who've watched a number of the same shows that you have is limited now that there's, you know, 100 some channels, 10 streaming networks, and all that. I do feel that we've lost something in a common experience.
Well, all I know is my earliest experiences with television. Television was brand new when I was a kid. It was only like 4 years old, television. And the earliest shows, the writers that these comedies had, they didn't learn to write from, you know, watching TV. They didn't learn to write from, you know, from going to movies. They all had literary backgrounds, for real. That's why the stuff was so good. And then eventually it just got watered down to, how did you learn to write? Oh, I just would watch YouTube. And, yeah.
I mean, that would explain a lot of the trash on TV right now. It is funny, too, when you have that many channels and that many options, that there still seems to be nothing worth watching half the time.
Yeah, but I think it's human nature to just become cliche after a while, because nobody wants that kind of pressure of, you know, hitting the bullseye every time.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the one nice thing about modern TV and streaming is that you do have so many options to watch the older programs that you enjoyed when you were younger, or that you missed completely when you were younger. You have a second shot at enjoying them again.
Well, this is a really interesting time, the past, I would say, 20 years, where generations, you know, that came along later were discovering stuff that made people go crazy, you know, 30 years before they were born. And some of it was television. And music, you know, I mean, I've listened to young people listen to the Beach Boys stuff on YouTube and watch it and go, man, we got so gypped. Why was everything so good? Why was everything just so perfect? You know, and it's like the answer to that is found in a movie called, what was it called? Midnight in Paris. You know, where
I actually don't know it.
Where the Woody Allen character is trying to figure out why everything was so unbelievably great before he was born. You know, and then he realizes it because he meets all these people that he idolized and looked up to. Some of them were generations apart. It was a total fantasy, but they'd be playing cards. And, you know, he'd be playing cards with Ernest Hemingway, and then he would meet another guy, Louis Malle, and he found out that each one of those guys was him, wondering why everything was so perfect and unbelievable before they were born, before they came along.
Yeah.
I thought that was one of the greatest movies ever, because it explains something that everybody wonders about. It's like, why is everything garbage now, you know?
Yeah, I guess there's a universal truth about perspective, I guess.
Yes.
Everything.
Well, it's an endless cycle.
I mean, I guess that is true. Everything does seem simpler in the past, but I guess people do say, if you were to live at that moment, you probably would have felt totally different, and it didn't feel so simple for them.
I don't know. It's just the human condition. But there are some firebrands, you know, like, I know there's like young women and young guys out there that have listened to stuff, grew up on stuff and studied it and wanted to be like the stuff that I had done, or my peers, you know, my friends. I know that there's people that want to be faithful to something that became a standard instead of ignoring it. you know, wanted the perpetuity. You keep it going.
I think that's one of the reasons I do always feel disappointed that something like Project Geeker that I did love isn't available really anywhere anymore, which is such a shame. I was watching some of the episodes in preparation for the interview, wanted to, you know, get a second feel for them. Mm-hmm. And I think there are three episodes available on Amazon, and that's it. I mean, even YouTube does not have a decent copy of one episode. I thought that was tragic.
No, it just depends on, you know, who's out there and who has passion. Those are the people that dig up stuff and put it up as soon as they can. Or people who may have videotaped it, you know, in its time. But I'm just glad that I did it. I'm glad that I had the opportunity. I'm grateful. And I still am to this day for any kind of opportunities to work. And my goal is to just, I'm thinking about people's enjoyment of it and hope it makes them happy, because, you know, I did not have a happy childhood, but I've met so many generations of people that were little kids and then they became middle-aged and old people that grew up or came through the periods that I had covered with my work. And they all were like, you know, I couldn't believe how good I had it because I was watching the shows you were on. And that makes me happy. It means that I achieved what my goal was.
Well, once again, you also did one of the shows that the fan base of is still absolutely massive. I think your most famous role, I may be wrong, but it seems like one of your most famous roles is Fry on Futurama.
Well, he was basically me. When I was 25, I was all whiny and complainy and nasally. And I was like, oh, man, I was in bands. Oh, man, I broke a string. Now what am I supposed to do? You know? And I sounded exactly like that, mealy. And so I decided to use that. And it was kind of a smart decision. I said, I want to try to do one voice that nobody could copy. And that's usually your own voice. Very hard to grab a hold of an impression of somebody's real voice and not a put-on voice.
Now, I might be wrong, and my ears may have played some tricks on me, but is it possible that the voice of Fry changed a little bit from the first couple of episodes?
Yeah. What happens is everybody starts at a certain level of everything, and then as time goes on, the characters find themselves. They become what they were ultimately supposed to be. You know, that's why the first episode of The Simpsons, Homer sounds like, I don't know, 180 degrees away from what he sounds like now.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a work in progress. Those shows are just works in progress, and things morph and they change, but it's what they were ultimately supposed to be.
So when you, what was your thought process in raising the voice of it?
What do you mean? Like in creating a voice or?
When you created Fry and you decided to alter the voice later, maybe a few episodes in,
yeah.
What was your thought into going in that direction?
Well, I thought of him in terms of a guy that's like most guys. You know, he thinks he's cool, but he's not really. But it's good that he has this self-confidence that can be shattered in a moment because he has mood swings. But the thing is I thought in terms of him being in love or looking for love, and that I wanted him to be a project for a girl.
Yeah.
You know, that's why it was always like, oh, Fry, you know, because he was a project. It's like, you know, do you have to wear that? Or what about your hair? You know, why don't you get that cut? You know, I don't know. I think women like a project. They're frustrated with it, but they're fascinated by what they can do with it.
I hope so, because that would explain why my wife loves me the project. But if you don't mind, my wife is actually a huge fan of yours, and my wife's name is Joey Lane. She would love to ask you a question, if you don't mind.
Sure.
All right, Joey, go right ahead.
Hello, Mr. West.
Hi.
Thank you for taking the time to answer my question.
Sure.
I absolutely enjoy your work, Futurama. My question's on Futurama. It's my absolute wicked favorite comfort show. So you play many of the cast members, including four characters, the Professor Fry, Dr. Zoidberg, and Zap Brannigan.
Yes.
of those four, who would you say you most enjoyed voice acting? Who do you, like, who could you imagine yourself being if you were that character?
Well, it's always more fun to play the asshole or a villainous person. It's always more fun. So I got a kick out of being, you know, this pig-headed, you know, guy trying to be macho and, you know, and he's a coward and he's acting brave. I love all these juxtaposed traits packed into one character, you know, where he would be like, you know, he would give orders to go fight these enemy starships. And he said, if you're looking for me, I'll be hiding in the bathroom or something.
So
I'll be in my chambers. Yeah.
So, I mean, considering how many characters you play in Futurama and they're often playing against each other or in dialogue with another, is it hard to do so many voices of different characters at once in dialogue with one another?
No, not for me. It never was. I kind of liked it that I could go through six pages, printed pages, and there'd be three, four characters talking to each other. And I wouldn't break it up. I would just continue the conversation. I was just lucky like that. But you had to have, you know, really distinctive changes. You couldn't let one voice bleed into the next one, you know, and not have it be consistent.
I mean, did you ever find when you're switching from voice to voice, like, do you ever accidentally still leave yourself in the prior voice when you're trying to do the other character for a moment?
Yes. Yes. It happened once at a table read. And I went to go read something and I read it in the wrong voice. And it was like, you could hear a pin drop. Everybody was like, oh my God. You know, like there was something really wrong with me.
I mean, honestly, I don't think I could ever remember how to do that many voices.
I don't know. I try to come up with something. I think long and hard when I'm doing anything. I think long and hard about the character before I go to record anything with it. I want to make sure that it's there for the ages, you know, like an evergreen. And these are the kind of characters in Futurama that you could actually know, even though some of them are grotesques. They're characters that you could actually know in your real life, and people like that. They could believe the character of Fry, that he really was that, you know, innocent and making mistakes and not speaking the right way, and he couldn't say things that he meant, you know. That's what makes a character interesting.
Well, I'm going to cut myself off just for a moment. My wife wasn't, I jumped over her. I was truly going to say thank you. My wife just wanted to say thank you for answering the question. Joey?
Well, thank you again for answering my question, and it was really nice talking to you, and I hope you have a good night.
Oh, thank you. I hope you do too.
Yeah, we actually had the opportunity, I think, to meet you in Boston. You were very nice enough to sign an autograph for her. And we actually wrote quite a bit.
The professor was my absolute favorite.
So going back to some of the characters, when you are performing the different voices in one line dialogue, do they only record one voice at a time, or do you go back and forth doing the same recording?
No, I used to do that on Ren and Stimpy. I would record the script in one character and I'd go back and do another character. And then if there were incidentals or additional characters, I'd go back and do those. And they would, you know, splice it together.
One thing, it's amazing how successful Futurama is, and looking back on it, how successful that it became. But it has a very unique history as far as being on air. The show was canceled in 2003. Mm-hmm. Returned as movies in 2009. Mm-hmm. Aired on television again in 2010. When it was shut down in 2003, were there any indications that it was ever going to come back, or was everyone pretty convinced that it was dead?
I never really knew. You know, no one was saying anything. It was just, I just thought that's life. You know, everything has its time, and all fads must die. You know, and I was very pragmatic about the whole thing, you know, always looking forward. But I did know one thing about Futurama. It was just too good to not be on television.
Mm.
Yeah. And that's what I held out, you know, my hope for, is that it was just so good. How could someone let it lay?
Well, were you at all surprised when the demand became so strong that they brought it back?
I was not surprised by that, because I knew that I could feel the heat of the fan base. I mean, I read, I had posts and letters, you know, that I read, and then people were like so passionate about it, so in love with it. And I said, well, I sure hope it'll come back. I still have a little separation anxiety.
Yeah. I mean, you must miss the show a lot that now that it's not on air anymore. It felt, you could feel that there was a strong connection between the actors and the characters. And as you're saying a little about separation anxiety, it must feel hard to not have that character.
Yeah, but you know, in my life, it's like one set of characters comes and another goes. And, you know, I'm always kind of busy with the immediacy of the business. But anytime I want, I can just, you know, put my head back and imagine them all out there, you know, exploring these planets and doing their missions and running into absurd situations. You know, it was real to me.
I can't help think about that one. The best experience on the show had to be, or maybe it's just in my mind, the episode where you guys crossed over with The Simpsons. Because once again, that's two pretty much classic legendary shows being combined.
Yes, that was a brilliant move. I mean, I thought it was great that they would do that. I had never been on The Simpsons. I'd been made fun of on The Simpsons. When I was doing Ren and Stimpy, The Simpsons had an episode where they were the Cartoon Awards or something, and they were going to give it to Ren and Stimpy, but the clip wasn't available, which was a joke aimed at the inconsistency of delivery of episodes of Ren and Stimpy. You know, they made six of them, and they just showed them over and over and over every week. And so that's what the joke was a shot at.
I actually never knew that.
Yeah. And then one time they did show a fake clip of Ren and Stimpy. I don't know who did my voice. I think it was probably Hank Azaria. But they did the both voices of Ren and Stimpy that I did. It was probably also Dan Castellaneta, I imagine. I was flattered. I was thrilled.
When there's a moment like that, do you guys feel like excited about that show like that as the audience did knowing it was happening?
Yeah, I mean, you know, most of the time I get the jokes. Some of them are so clever that I don't get it the first time around, but I do it anyway. And sometimes there's these really happy accidents. Like, I didn't get a joke in an episode where David Cohen was directing, and somebody said to Fry, "Hey, Fry, I heard beer makes you stupid." And he says, "No, it doesn't." And he stopped, and I said, "That doesn't make any sense." You know, because I just totally missed it. I spaced out. And I go, "David, no, I'm doesn't." He goes, "Yes, please read it as written." And I said, "Okay, but I'll be back for the $700 fix." And next thing you know, I saw it on TV and I was like, wow! That's so beautiful, because I didn't know what I was saying. And Fry said it. So that was the most honest acting I had ever done.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So when you shot that episode, did you perform it with the cast from Simpsons, or is it shot separately?
We were with the actress that did Marge Simpson, and we were also with the actor that does Homer Simpson, Dan Castellaneta. And I think that was about it from the cast. You know, and the other people came in and did their stuff later, but, you know, we're in there working with at least two of them.
What is it about Futurama, do you think, that makes the show so timeless?
The writing. The writing and the charm of the characters. You know, it was like it became a perfect situation. The writing was snappy, like ahead of beat. It was like two beats ahead of everybody else's kind of style. And, you know, I loved it. I just loved it. I embraced it. And that's why it felt so comfortable. Everybody felt the same way. And I hold all the actors that I've worked with in high esteem. I mean, genuine love of them and their performances.
I mean, yeah, I mean, you do. I mean, you had Katie Sagal on Futurama. You had John DiMaggio on that. Were you guys tight, as it seems like on the show, that the character was as tight? Or, I mean, do you guys kind of, I mean, do you guys still stay tight with each other?
No, we were tight with each other, but we were family. And we became that, and we're still like that, except everybody's got to live their own life. But, you know, whenever there's a chance to hang out, oh God, I'll jump on it. You know, like when we do these conventions and stuff, you know, what are you doing for lunch? What are you doing for dinner? You know, all right, we'll call Mo, and we'll call Lauren Tom, and we'll get Tress McNeil.
Yeah.
Phil Lamar.
It might just be me, because honestly, I don't live in the voice performer community. I just feel like the community of voice actors seems very tight. And it seems like there's a lot of mixing of TV shows that you guys have all been in with each other. Mm-hmm. Not just on Futurama and The Simpsons, but throughout animated work.
Well, they're tight because they do a craft, and all of them are superlatives at that craft. Like, there's nobody better. The group that you usually see and hear, there's nothing better than that. And, you know, I think hiring celebrities just for stunt casting is a step down in performance quality. You know, that's the way it is, you know.
So it is a pretty tight group then. I mean, like some of you on our show, you know, we had Rob Paulson, we had Jim Cumming, you know, I'm talking to you as well. Mm-hmm. And it does seem like there always are shows when we're doing our research that everyone has basically, like, if you did that 6-3, the Kevin Bacon thing, but with voice actors, everyone has been like a degree away.
I don't know. I have a genuine love for all those people, including the guy you just mentioned, Rob Paulson. I've always thought the world of him. I held him in really high esteem, as I do mostly all my colleagues. It's respect. It's the respect for the craft too.
Do you guys, I mean, is there, when you bump into a newer voice actor, what kind of advice do you give them about the craft itself?
Usually they'll just show up and they'll be kind of quiet and, you know, and they got hired to work with us and everything. And at the end, somebody will always say, just like I used to say when I started out, oh man, do you know what it's like for me to sit in this room with you and to be performing with you? I mean, I remember when I was like that in New York City, all these giants that I walk into a room and I'm like the newbie, and they were people that rocked and moved my world, and to be with them. And I say the same thing they told me, hey, we're saving a seat for you. You know,
that's really cool. That's extreme. I'm sure that's a relief for them to hear that from someone they've idolized.
But it's like, it's meant with the truest of intentions. You know, it's like, we'll be here, we'll support you, you know, but you gotta learn to shoot bullseyes and, you know, 3-point shots all the time.
That's cool. So now you're doing voice work for a show called Goblins Animated. Is that correct?
Yes.
Can you tell our listeners about that show a bit?
Well, It was a project for quite a while. I mean, I don't know if they had the funds to keep it moving forward consistently, but yeah, I did voices on it. I thought it was interesting. I've seen like the pencil tests of it, but that's about it.
Okay. Oh, it hasn't even aired yet?
I don't think so.
It's kind of like, when I was doing some research on, you know, looking up for that show, and I found the cast, and the cast on it is incredible. You have Tara Strong on it,
yep.
Jim Cumming,
yep.
Phil Lamar. I mean, it's a hell of a cast that's attached to that.
Those are the usual suspects, you know. They're just so good that people want to work with them. And you'll always hear those names for just about anything that comes out.
But at the same time, Billy West is you're part of that list as well. I mean, it's pretty much an all-star group.
Yeah. Well, because they never run out of gas. You know, when a celebrity comes in, they have the luxury of pretty much doing who and exactly what they are, you know, for a voice. And that's like, I resent that. I wish I had that luxury.
Right.
But I don't. I'm not a celebrity. If I was a big celebrity, I could just come in and talk like this for every character.
Yeah. Is there anyone who can startle that fence that you think does a good job of settling that fence between being the celebrity and also the great voice actor?
I always thought of Eddie Murphy, and I always thought of Mike Myers.
Oh, right.
Yeah, because they were voices that weren't them. They changed physically to sound like something else. And I always admired that. You know, some people cannot separate from the tone of their voice, no matter what little character they're doing. It ain't easy, you know. I mean, it's easy for some people, but those are the freaks like me.
Is it at all, you think maybe ego, that when they're those celebrities, they want people to know that it's them, they don't want to hide themselves? Well, a voice actor, once again, you guys do phenomenal voices, but it means that you as an individual is not as recognized from, you know, saying people hear your voice, they don't know me, so because you used to make different voices, but there's a celebrity doing their own, so you know it's them. So don't say, is it like an ego part right there?
I don't know. I mean, I know voice people that can piss circles around celebrities. And I don't mean just voiceovers, acting-wise.
Mm.
Stage acting. I know people. But that isn't all they're able to do. They have hundreds of voices in stock, you know, to be able to use or to create or dream up. That's what I care about. You know, and now it's funny. It's like, they all want to do voiceover. They used to look down their nose at us, you know, celebrity types. It's like, ugh, cartoons. And, you know, it was always like that in a way, because then there were theater actors that would never want to do anything on television. Ugh, television. I want to act in a box, a piece of furniture in somebody's living room, you know.
Yeah.
But now they're forced into doing it. It's either that or, you know, make pizzas at Costco.
But a lot of the best television right now does come from animation. I mean, and it does help to have something like Netflix as well, that once again is not only allowing animation on their show, but is allowing for a greater range of the type of animation.
Yes. Yeah. I don't know. I just always viewed it very pragmatically. It's like, you know, having celebrities doing voiceovers is like sending a bunch of highly skilled plumbers to go win the World Series for you. You know what I mean? They're really great at what they do, but they don't belong in certain arenas.
I mean, when you're as a voice actor, how much of it is pure? Is it skill? How much of it is it? Do you practice attempting different voices, whether or not those voices are ones that are actually for a show, but just see if you can hit a certain range or anything like that?
Well, yeah. I mean, if, you know, I used to do it a lot more, just like Tourette-ing out noises and voices. But that was when I was younger. I pretty much know where to find something if I need to find it. Like if a new character pops up in life that you're going to have to be working with. And, you know, I know how to do it now. I mean, I don't have to search for stuff really. You know, I know what something needs, at least as far as my sensibilities go.
Through your long career, and you do have a tendency to play the good guys. Does that sound right? And is there a reason that you gravitate towards maybe at least the more innocent type characters, like Fry and Geeker and a few others?
Well, if that's the way it's perceived, I'm happy with that. You know, I mean, I've always been like a good guy, except when I was, you know, younger and I was wild and I was playing in bands and stuff and I wasn't such a great guy. But, you know, I mean, I just enjoy any kind of character that evokes a feeling in somebody. That's what's important to me.
Well, like I said, I think you brought a lot of joy to a lot of viewers. And like I said, I've loved your shows. I've loved, like I said, Project Geek was big, Futurama, big, just franchise. Was another great show that you did. And I just want to thank you very much for spending your time with me. I think you were extremely generous with your time.
Oh, thank you very much. It was a pleasure, really, to talk about the craft.
Well, like I said, anytime you want to come on and promote, actually, I guess I should ask, or is there a show you're looking to, that you're coming out soon that you're a part of, that you might want to give a shout out to?
I could, but I can't divulge.
Oh, okay. You have a secret show that you'll get to tell us one day?
I think it's a secret, yeah.
But absolutely no worries. When it's time to promote that, I do hope you come back and talk with me about it.
Sure thing.
Thank you so much.
And we're back, man. So I want to ask you a question about this.
Yeah.
What's your favorite voice that he did? We already talked about Bugs Bunny, but besides Bugs Bunny and Philip J. Fry, if you had to pick one, what do you think it is?
Honestly, I mean, for me, it's going to be Philip J. Fry. Nah. Futurama. Yeah. I'm sorry. Futurama, I mean, that was a big part of my teenage years. I mean, it came out right whenever I was becoming a teenager. The Simpsons were already out for such a long period of time, and I kind of just got sick of it at that point. And Futurama was one of those shows that it felt like I should not be watching it. Right. My mom let me watch it. So I'm going to have to go with Philip J. Fry. And come on, it has one of the best cartoon animated moments, in my opinion. The episode with – I think it's one of the – no, maybe it's a middle episode. I can't remember. But with the dog and the dog being left behind and everything like that. So Futurama is such an amazing show for me. And Philip J. Fry was just, you know, such an amazing voice, an iconic voice in animation.
He's also, you know – Professor Farnsworth, Dr. Zoidberg, Zap Brannigan, Richard Nixon. I mean, so many characters in that show. It's
Zap Brannigan is great too. only because of just, you know, the play on William Shatner with it. You know, I love that. So
yeah. Oh. So Billy, thanks so much for coming on. If you ever want to come back on again, let us know. We'd love to have you come back on and chat again. You have an incredible career. I've actually met him at Comic-Con years ago down in San Diego, and he's incredibly nice in person. So he's so appreciative of his fans. It's so cool. He gave everybody who came to his table, you know, time to talk with him and not just like a push him off thing. Like you say, some people do. He gave everybody their time to chat and talked with them, whether they were buying an autograph or a signed photo or not. He, you know, chatted, everybody talked about, you know, the characters he did. It was really cool because sometimes you see people at a shows, I'm not going to say any names, but they're like, very much they're checked out. They don't want to be there. They're just there for the paycheck. And it really seemed like, you know, Billy West, when he was there, you know, for the experience with the fans, and it was really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I've not gotten to see him, but that's pretty awesome. Yeah. I'd love to hear stories about that when it comes to celebrities.
Oh, me too, man. It's fun. But anyways, I think that's a show for this, but if you liked that interview and you liked what you heard here, you need to go to spoilerverse.com and check out all of the Spoiler Country back episodes. And while you're also there, you're going to check out other shows like Robert's Bridge and the Gate Gems, where he talks about breaking news and all stuff, pop culture, of the stuff that's coming out and some cool stuff there. Nerds from the Crypt, because they do horror stuff. And you go over to see Funny Book Forensics, because they talk about deep dives into comic books you know and love. They just did a really good deep dive on Huntress, which is a lot of fun. And then this month only, over on Haphazard Adventures, Kaylee and I are doing, once again, our beer advent calendar, where we post an episode every day for the month of December, which is a pain in the ass. But we review a beer in our advent calendar every day, and it's a lot of fun. So go check that out.
Also, I mean, if you want more content when it comes to everything Spoilerverse, definitely head to Spoilerverse.com for articles, breaking news, press releases from companies like Marvel, Mad Cave. What is it? Y2Z? Is that the other company?
Z2C.
Z2C. Yeah. Yeah. So many great things coming from the Spoilerverse there. The Rumorverse, as we mentioned earlier, such an amazing little area on the website where you can see all the different rumors that are coming up in pop culture, movies, and everything like that.
Yep. And go to our store, buy a t-shirt, buy a hoodie, buy a face mask, look fly as hell. And that face mask helps protect other people from the coronavirus. So it's great for you to have, not to look cool, but also to protect your fellow man or woman.
Yeah,
you do
absolutely.
That. You do that, we get money. Money is good. Money pays for things like putting these episodes out and getting us equipment and doing stuff to make sure we can keep doing this stuff for everybody at no cost other than you going and purchasing something from our store.
Now, if you want to continue the conversation with everything in Spoilerverse, you know, you want to wear the apparel, you want to check out the website, but you want to talk to all of us, all the creators behind the Spoilerverse, check out our Discord. You can go there, talk to me, talk to Johnny, talk to Kendrick, talk to anybody within the Spoilerverse, the people who write the articles, make the podcasts, and it's just so much fun.
Yeah, and if you want to do that, just go to scpod.us/Discord, and you can join that public Discord server at any time. Once again, scpod.us/Discord. Well, Robert, or Bobbert, or Mr. Slavinsky, or whatever you want me to call you today, I think it's come that time where we have wrapped up the show and we need to do the one last thing we have to do.
All right, what's that?
InNotions, a podcast.
We're Cthulhu.
And as Cthulhu compels you to do,
open the mind
and read more.